Hi, everyone. This is Lynn Harder, co-producer and host of Defining Moments podcast. I'm delighted you've tuned in for today's episode. We're joined by Dr. Emily Cripe. Emily is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Communication at Kutztown University. Emily's teaching and research focus on health and organizational communication, and her work brings much-needed attention to women's health and healthcare. At the heart of this episode are two articles published in Health Communication. The first, authored by Emily, is titled The Scarlet Sea. She's the lead article titled Coming to Terms with Our Race Car Brains, Academic Mothers Experiencing Adult Diagnosis of ADHD. Taken together, these pieces invite us to consider the uncertain and often stigmatized health experiences of women, as well as their communication, the work they do in pursuing diagnoses and advocating for themselves and others. Emily, thank you for elevating the experience of women in your work, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Emily, both of the articles that we're featuring today are autoethnographic essays. For listeners who might be unfamiliar with this research method, can you talk a bit about what autoethnography is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. That's a question that I get asked a lot. My brother is a medical doctor, and when he read one of my pieces, he just went, "Oh, this is not what our research articles are like." So, yes, it is. It's very different, and I sometimes get asked too about just the vulnerability that's involved in writing something that's autoethnographic. Yeah. So I like to tell my students, I think words are important and fascinating. And so I like to talk to them about the etymology of words. And ethnography is a particularly good one for that. So ethnography comes from ethno, meaning culture, and graphy, meaning writing. So ethnography being writing about culture. And so when we do ethnography, we study, cultural groups of people. But then when we do autoethnography, it's about ourselves as well. So it's, in a way, a mix of, if you're to describe it as a mix of ethnography and autobiography. But it's different from simply an autobiography of a memoir in that it involves more of an analysis and tying in with larger cultural themes and things that are going on, research that's out there. But I think it's a particularly powerful form of inquiry because of the way that it can give us a unique understanding of embodied experiences. And because we as researchers bring ourselves to the research that we do, this just in many ways foregrounds that side of things.
Absolutely. And our personal embodied, using the word that you used, right, in and through our bodies, our vulnerable stories and experiences become then scaffolds for raising questions about cultural concerns. And in your essays, you do this beautifully. You raise questions like, how is it that we socially construct what constitutes a natural birth? Mm-hmm. How do diagnostic labels both help us and hurt us? And you explore these questions in deeply personal contexts, but you don't stay stuck in your story. As you said, you connect your experiences to broader cultural, social, even political phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And you do it really well. Yeah. The second article that we're featuring today is interesting because it's a collaborative autoethnography. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple people. Can you briefly introduce your co-authors and talk to us about what that was like to do a collaborative autoethnography?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I was interested in exploring, right, ADHD diagnosis amongst adult women in more depth, and was part of a group on social media of academic women who are mothers who have ADHD. And so thought it would be useful not just to talk about my own experience, but to also explore that with some others who have had the same experience. And so I reached out in that group to see who else might be interested in doing this and doing a collaborative autoethnography about our experiences with ADHD. And so I was able to work together with Sarah Simons-LeBlanc, who is at Purdue Fort Wayne, and Micah Eilert, who is at University of Nebraska, and Kim Bernhardt at NYU. And so we worked together to collaboratively discuss our experiences with this adult diagnosis of ADHD and motherhood and being academics all together.
I can only imagine that that was potentially a cathartic experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely is because as we discussed in the article, it's a complex experience to get that diagnosis as an adult and then retrospectively make sense of our experiences in life. And of course, there's a lot of wondering, right? What would my life have been like if I had known this younger and how this would have been? And so, there was definitely a lot of catharsis in our discussion together and working together on this project.
Well, on behalf of readers and listeners, I thank you all for your bravery and willingness to enter into that space of vulnerability to reckon with experiences. I believe your stories will become equipment for living, in Kenneth Burke's sense, for other people who are walking through similar situations but might not have a story to help them explain what's going on. So kudos to you. Let's delve in to your first article, Emily, titled The Scarlet Sea. In this essay, you explore your journey delivering your first child via cesarean section. For listeners who haven't read your essay, I'm hoping that you could read the first paragraph of that essay for us.
Sure, absolutely. I'm 13 or 14, sitting on an exam table, my legs dangling off the side, the paper folding and crunching beneath me. My parents sit to my side, and Dr. Washington, my neurosurgeon, faces me, dwarfing the squeaky little round wheeled stool reserved for the doctor. This is a post-surgery visit, a few months after Dr. Washington has operated to correct a rare neural defect that I was born with, but which was only diagnosed a few weeks before she first saw me. I have an Arnold Chiari malformation, type 2, which manifested in a quirky collection of symptoms when I hit puberty and started to grow rapidly. A strange pain in the back of my neck when I coughed or laughed, which happened often, sleep apnea, scoliosis, headaches, and perhaps most alarmingly, the sudden atrophy of the muscles in my right leg all collaborated to lead me to her care.
I can close my eyes, Emily, and see you as a young teen with your legs dangling off the table. I can hear the squeaky wheels. I can imagine the paper that drapes over that exam table. And I'm able to do all of that because of the vivid and artful writing that you offer that really transports us into that setting. Something that's probably really hard for most people to comprehend as a teenager or as a parent of a teenager who's having brain surgery.
Yeah. I don't think I fully understood the experience, like what it was like for my parents. Well, until now that I'm a parent, of course. And then also, I remember when my dad was first diagnosed with cancer, my mom said that this isn't as bad as when you had your brain surgery. And I was baffled how it's cancer, right? Brain surgery was no big deal, right? For me as the child going through it, but that experience being so different for my parents as well. But yeah, thank you.
As a teenager, you had this brain surgery to correct a rare neural tube defect. Mm-hmm. The visit that you narrate ends with Dr. Washington saying to you, when you have children, you'll need to have a C-section. Flash forward 20 years and you're pregnant with your first child. The advice you were given 2 decades prior becomes a bit more uncertain, right? As you and your husband are considering different birth preferences. Can you talk to us about how that initial plan became contested terrain?
Yeah, sure, of course. So, for 20 years, I had in the back of my head, oh yeah, when I have kids, I'm supposed to have a C-section. But then when I actually became pregnant, right, I started to think about that a little bit more and revisit it. And I had done some research and found, you know, in that 20 years, the rate of diagnosis of Chiari malformations has increased because MRIs have become more widely available and less expensive. And so more and more people are going in for an MRI because they have headaches and they're finding like a type 1 Chiari malformation, for example. And so there are studies out there showing that, women with Chiari malformations can sometimes not have C-sections and there's other alternatives and things like that. So, that was definitely something I wanted to explore with my doctors to say, well, is this still the case, right? 20 years ago, that was the case, but is it still the case now? When we first saw the maternal fetal medicine specialists, we talked about that and they sort of said, well, could go one way, could go the other. We could do forceps. We could do lots of things. Why don't you go see a neurosurgeon now, right? Because Dr. Washington, the pseudonym, isn't practicing anymore. She's retired. So I went and saw the neurosurgeon now, 10 years ago, and said, hey, so, you know, I have this history of a Chiari. It is, according to the MRI most recently, considered to be resolved. And so I'm not still experiencing symptoms from that. Do I still need to have a C-section? And the neurosurgeon said, yes, yep, you should still have a C-section. Absolutely. Right? You shouldn't be pushing. And I said, okay, great. That settles it. Fine. I feel kind of relieved. I don't have to make a decision and forceps and all of these things. And then just a couple days later, we had our second visit with maternal fetal medicine and saw a different doctor that day who said, well, medically, there's no reason that you should need to have a C-section. And really seemed to be concerned about their own rates of C-sections and not having those be too high. That was a really uncomfortable and unsettling experience because, I had just been told by a brain specialist that for the sake of my brain, I should have a C-section. And then this other doctor is arguing with that. But it didn't really feel like it was about me. It felt like it was more about just this general societal trend of, unnecessary C-sections and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. As I'm listening to you, I'm reminded, Emily, that the experience of health and healthcare, the practice of medicine, are always already uncertain for both patients and physicians. And part of it is because our medical knowledge is shifting, as you indicated. Technologies are more readily available and emergent. There's diagnostic uncertainty, and then there's uncertainty surrounding how any given patient, right, will experience a procedure. And so all of that is at play, but it's also not happening in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. Your childbirth, which ultimately was done through a C-section, occurred in this broader societal context in which C-sections are considered unnatural. And people can't see me right now, but literally I have quotations around the word unnatural. That's for you, sure. Emily.
Yes, yes.
So C-sections are considered unnatural, and mothers who have C-sections often experience stigma. In fact, the title of your article comes from a blog in which a mom reflects on her scar as her own scarlet C, her very own scarlet letter for her C-section. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you understand stigma?
Yeah, sure, definitely. So stigma, I mean, I talked about this in the article, that Goffman says stigma refers to bodily signs designed to expose something unusual and bad about the moral status of the signifier. So things become stigmatized when they're attached to shame, when they feel shameful, when mm-hmm. we feel as though others view them as indicating something bad morally about us as people and our experiences. And this is often attached to medical issues. I actually was thinking just this morning about how we're seeing that a lot in society with, there has, you know, for a long time been stigma attached to being overweight. And now that we have these new drugs, right, Ozempic and these GLPs and things like that, I worry a little bit about whether the existence of those is going to exacerbate the stigma associated with being overweight mm-hmm. in our society, since many people are losing a lot of weight on these drugs, right? And mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because alongside that, you have a growing group of people who call themselves fat activists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Body positivity.
Yes. They're reclaiming that label and trying to destigmatize and reframe that. And really emphasize that health comes in a lot of different forms and in a lot of different bodies. And in general, from my perspective, urge us to kind of lean into curiosity in lieu of judgment. Let's just be curious, right? Mm-hmm.
And there's so much conflict in all of this too, right? I think to some extent, people feel like there's a stigma against using those drugs because other people might view it as sort of, right, cheating, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. Losing weight mm-hmm. with drugs instead of through, you know, good old fashioned diet and exercise or whatnot, which we know doesn't work for everyone. And so, yeah, it's really complex, the ways that stigma can operate in both directions.
Yeah, yeah. Hi, folks. This is Lynn breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Dr. Emily Cripe about the uncertain and often stigmatized experiences of women, as well as their communication work in pursuing diagnoses and advocating for themselves and others. For your convenience, we've placed links to her recently published articles in Health Communication in the show notes and on our Facebook page. Okay, back to the conversation. How did you experience stigma surrounding your C-section?
Well, I mean, I think the first time I really thought much about it was that encounter with that maternal fetal medicine specialist who, you know, said, oh, there's medically no reason to do it, and that sort of thing. But then I also encountered it in a lot of the things that I was reading when I was pregnant, you know, going into this first birth, this first pregnancy, you know, a lot of the medical things talking about, you know, how C-sections are overdone. And then in personal interactions as well, I, you know, had a friend who kind of said, oh, well, why do you need a C-section? Have you talked to a doula or a midwife? Because doctors are really just so quick to do C-sections these days, right? And in encountering that, I started thinking about it a lot more and reading about it more and reflecting on, you know, that I started to feel like if I was telling people I needed to have a C-section, I was having a C-section, that I needed to have a justification behind it, right? So that I could be a good, having a C-section for good reasons and not, you know, just because I didn't want to push or something along those lines. So, you know, the more I read about it, the more it became very clear that there's been such a strong movement towards, right, natural birth, even unmedicated labor, things like that. And it's really, all of that is very personal between women and their doctors and their experiences, and things very rarely go as planned. And I have a lot of sympathy for women who didn't know going in that they would have a C-section, but something goes awry and that ends up being the safest choice for them. And they end up feeling like they didn't have a choice in those situations. But I think in those cases in particular, that stigma is particularly negative in its effects, and it compounds, right, the guilt that they feel for not having the kind of childbirth that they wanted to. One thing that I've heard is that C-sections are safer for the baby, but more dangerous for the mother. And natural birth is sort of the opposite. And I think that that's something that's kind of interesting and sheds a different light on those choices.
Yeah. It's interesting because in some ways, the stigma that arises surrounding C-sections is an unintended consequence of this movement afoot now for a good 10 years in the U.S. that has challenged the medicalization of childbirth, right? And yet what that movement is doing is important. It's asking questions about the cascade of interventions that oftentimes ripple out of control really easily. So mother is, the contractions aren't speeding up, and so they're given Pitocin. When you're given Pitocin, it speeds up those contractions. It also increases more pain, and that leads to another intervention, which is an epidural. Epidural slows down the contractions, so you get more Pitocin. And so these cascade of interventions oftentimes end up in a C-section. And when you're in that delivery room and you're told that the life of your child could be on the line, of course, you follow those doctor's orders. And so people have challenged, right, kind of that process. And yet in that movement, what we haven't seen, and I think what your story moves us to pay attention to, is that choice is not always an option.
Absolutely. Choices are very, you know, they're constrained by the things that are going on around us. And I understand, right, that women want to feel empowered in giving birth. You know, I mean, if you look at historically, that they used to just knock women out for a whole experience of labor, right? They gave them drugs and they were just like not consciously part of that experience. In reaction to that, I think, which I don't think that was a great approach, right? I think we sometimes swing too far in the other direction and miss some of the nuance of that. And I mean, I studied breastfeeding for my dissertation and some of my other earlier research. And, you know, I see women struggling with a lot of the same things with breastfeeding, where, you know, breastfeeding has to some extent been medicalized, and it's hard to encourage breastfeeding without stigmatizing bottle feeding, which is often sometimes necessary and sometimes the best choice for a given mother, depending on what they're dealing with. But then at the same time, women who breastfeed in public feel like they're, you know, being discriminated against. And so you can't win. It's like you can't win as a woman, right? With anything attached to, you know, childbirth, breastfeeding, all of that.
I don't know if you've come across the book by Dr. Maggie Quinlan and Bethany Johnson titled You're Doing It Wrong.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous historical exploration of how reproductive care in general right, is so contested and so difficult for moms. And in an age of social media, becomes even more intense because there's more surveillance and more potential opinions and judgments that swirl around. And like you said, when women are making those choices, those are in very particular circumstances. And oftentimes those circumstances are not understood by others. And
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in this case, right, with my son, I had reflected a lot on this and dealt with the C-section stigma and those choices and all of that going up to, right, when I went into labor with him before my C-section was scheduled. And then it turned out that he was breech. And in fact, had his head wedged under my rib cage. So if I had not had this history of having the Chiari and having to have a C-section anyway, you know, A, they would have encouraged a C-section with a breech baby. If I had said, no, I want to try to do a, you know, a breech birth vaginally, I don't know that either of us would have survived the way his head was wedged under my rib cage. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difficulty that they had getting him out with the C-section alone. And so, you know, especially looking back on that, really, that's, I almost wouldn't have had a choice in any case. But it's funny too, because since I wrote this article, I've given birth two more times. And when I, of the three times that I had C-section scheduled, I only actually had the C-section when scheduled once. My first and last children both decided they were coming earlier. And so, you know, when I went into labor with my daughter, I wasn't quite 39 weeks yet. And so they were like, oh, well, we're going to wait a little while and make sure that, you know, this is progressing and whatnot, which seemed a little silly to me. I wasn't just going to stop having contractions. They were pretty regular at that time. But then the doctor came in and gave me all of these warnings, which of course, you know, that there are risks, right, with any medical procedure. But he was talking about, oh, well, since this is your third C-section, there could be all this scar tissue and there could be all these complications. And I was thinking, but if I were to tell you, oh, well, in that case, I want to try to do a vaginal birth after C-section, I want a VBAC, you'd be arguing with me then too and telling me all the risks associated with that, right? And so it's just a really complex place that you find yourself.
Yeah. And in a healthcare medical maze in which issues of risk and liability are ever present and are also guiding, right, the actions of care providers. In listening to your stories and in reading your essay, I think there's two key takeaways for listeners that really illustrate the power of autoethnography and your storytelling. First, you poignantly argue that calling unmedicated childbirth natural implies that the way you are giving birth, if you have a C-section, is unnatural. And that's really hard for mothers to hold, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And to carry yeah. with them. Additionally, you reflect on the problematic nature of the language of birth plans, right? Because plans often go awry.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't really have a plan because you're not in control of all of this, right? You can have an ideal, you can have preferences, but you can't plan this.
Yeah. It is, again, we live in bodies that are resilient and vulnerable, and mm-hmm. we exist in a maze of healthcare that is always already uncertain. And most of the time, people are doing the best that they can to make choices with the information they have and to be able to step back and reflect on the unintended consequences and how we can care for the well-being of the mother emotionally as well as physically. I think it's a really compelling part of what you're doing.
Thank you.
It also connects with the second article that we're featuring, right? That also is dealing with women's healthcare issues. The experience of uncertainty and stigma are threads that are woven through your collaborative autoethnography. And in this article, you and other academic mothers are reflecting on receiving an adult diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We know that historically women have been underdiagnosed with ADHD, oftentimes present differently than males. And you and your co-authors are among an increasing number of women who in adulthood are receiving diagnoses. Can you talk to us a little bit about your experience of ADHD?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so hard to tease out things in your life when you look back on them that you go, oh yeah, no, I think that was also ADHD, right? And so it's funny to have this sort of retroactive examination of things. I think I always was someone who my dad's nickname for me, my middle name is Therese, and he would refer to me as Emily of the Trees, because my head was always like up in the clouds. So Emily Therese became Emily of the Trees, right? I was sort of up in the clouds, thinking about things, not always connected to what was happening right in front of me, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, those were sort of early childhood experiences with that. But, because I was a girl and because I was gifted, in the 80s, that was not what ADHD looked like, right? Instead of not being able to sit still in my chair in school, I got in trouble for talking when I wasn't supposed to be talking, right? That lack of impulse control and things like that. And then as I got older, I found that, I basically kept myself very, very busy, like in high school, doing all kinds of activities and things like that. Because if I was really busy, then I could get everything done because I had that sense of urgency and panic that essentially could allow me to do the things that I needed to do. But of course, that created a lot of anxiety too, right? That was sort of how I coped with my ADHD, was making myself anxious enough that I actually got the things done. Mm-hmm. But I often felt very overwhelmed and often also felt like I was kind of a failure, right? I wasn't living up to my potential. I couldn't just do these things that I was supposed to be able to do. Maybe I was just lazy, but that's a moral failure as well. And it was so hard because I would know I needed to do something and I would want to do it and I couldn't make myself do it. That's maybe just a very weird experience for somebody who hasn't had ADHD, but that was, a lot of my experience, throughout academics, throughout, grad school, things like that, until it came up to the deadline. I was very good at writing a paper the night before it was due. And that served me really well through high school and a lot of college. And then in grad school did not work very well. But I had coping mechanisms, right, that I had come up with throughout time. But I look back on grad school and the times I struggled with like anxiety or depression, I was anxious and depressed because I couldn't do the things that I knew I needed and wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so treated that, but didn't know that the root cause was really ADHD until I became a mother and then was dealing with those additional stresses and read someone's experience. This is why I think autoethnography is so powerful. And what I read was somebody's blog, but so not an autoethnography, but just hearing about other people's experiences really, I think, can be so transformative for us. So I read a blogger that I had always liked and followed, possibly because her brain worked a lot like mine in retrospect, who had just been diagnosed with ADHD and said, whoa, look at how ADHD manifests itself in women and girls. Oh my gosh. And I read it and went, oh yeah, no, that's me. Right. And so, but because I think of some of the stigma associated with ADHD, I didn't do anything about it right away. It took me a lot of time. I said, oh, well, I'll just bring that up at my next visit to my doctor in a year. basically, right? And I'll deal with that then. We'll, if I decide that that's something that I want to do something about, et cetera. And then I finally did and bring it up with her and went through the official process to get evaluated by a neuropsychologist and went through all this testing, which confirmed that yes, that is what I've been struggling with, and decided to try some medication, and it's absolutely changed my life. It has just been so transformative for me. And so, but this is something that I think a fair number of women struggle with, and it's only becoming better known very recently that happens.
A diagnosis and a treatment plan can change the landscape of a life. A bewildering array of experiences all of a sudden fall into place and make sense. And it's almost like naming a situation is like putting a handle on a door, and you're able to turn that knob and access life-changing resources.
Mm-hmm.
And not just medical resources, but a stock of stories that help you make sense of experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Knowing that you're not alone is a huge part of it, right? Knowing what it is that's going on with you.
Yeah. A really interesting part of your essay is how you and your collaborators talk about how a diagnosis is an ongoing defining moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that when you're diagnosed, your understanding of yourself is changed by that in a way that sort of can cascade, right? It's a continuous evolution of your understanding of yourself, and you think back on your experiences and it's really helpful in that it often allows you to forgive yourself, right? Mm-hmm. For things that you have viewed as failures, things that were attributed to, you being lazy or having some kind of personality flaw. Just the guilt that is often so present amongst folks with ADHD, just feeling like you're a failure as a person because you can't make it to things on time or, right, get these things done that are sort of, basic adulting, that those are really struggles for folks with ADHD. And so it's really cathartic to have that diagnosis. But it sort of is just a continuing evolution of our understanding of things that happened in the past and how they've shaped who we are now, and our understanding of our family members, because ADHD often runs in families. And I actually, two of my children have been diagnosed with ADHD. And I remember when my second child got diagnosed, I felt so guilty, because I felt like this was my fault, in a way that I had passed this to them. I shouldn't feel that way, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of gifts associated with having this kind of a brain, right? People with ADHD are so creative, right? And they have such great ideas that are so innovative. They're very imaginative, right? But this world is not built for these brains. And so, just knowing that both of my kids would be facing some of those struggles, I think was associated with some of that guilt. But also I had tried to constantly remind myself, right, that there are a lot of gifts associated with it as well. And we just have to learn how to focus on that. And also that they have the benefit that I didn't of being diagnosed as children and getting treatment early. And that actually will hopefully help them a lot as they grow and as they progress. So it's all tied up in a whole lot of things for us, and it's constantly evolving. That ongoing defining moment and understanding of yourself shaped differently through that lens of knowing that you have ADHD.
I think for me, one thing I will linger on is how we exist in bureaucratic structures. Both you and I are in higher education, but I think that this can equate to a lot of other organizational systems, and their built environments, and they're built around a sense of normalcy that is a construction. And if you are neurodivergent, how can we craft space within these seemingly rigid environments and iron cages in which people who think differently, move through the world differently, can thrive? And I think about the times I've failed to do that and how it's an ongoing aspiration. That shouldn't just be the responsibility of an individual
to
care for self, but how can we as society and as allies help support? Yeah. I wanna loop back to something that you said, Emily. You indicated that you delayed that conversation with your family physician for a year, in part because of the stigma that's associated with that label. Can you talk a little bit about how you've experienced and managed the stigma that you perceive surrounding ADHD?
Yeah, I do think that there are a number of people who are like me, who maybe delay getting an official diagnosis because of some of that stigma, right? That that I think that it's very misunderstood as a condition. I think that there's a maybe representation in popular culture, or sort of just a broader understanding of ADHD being squirrel, right? That people just absolutely can't pay attention to anything ever, which is often not the case. People with ADHD have too much attention and can hyper focus on projects they're very, very interested in, but really struggle to do the things that are more boring and mundane. Those can feel impossible and be very hard to focus on. And so, people who don't have an experience or an understanding of it, you know, oftentimes view it as, oh, well, you're just being lazy, or, you know, why can't you do these really basic adult things, that sort of thing. I do think that the landscape about this and mental health and things like that has all been changing in some ways that's really promising. Our understanding more broadly of neurodiversity and the conversations around embracing that are really promising. I mean, I think the kids are all right. Like, my students regularly share their diagnoses in class and are very open about those sorts of things. And that was not a thing that ever happened when I was in college, right? That wasn't something that people talked about or embraced or things like that. I have found that selectively sharing my diagnosis with ADHD, I think, can help my students because they see that I have some understanding of that experience, and I can sometimes share things that have helped me and maybe worked for me with that. But I'll say that, like, I think it helped us writing this article to write it collaboratively so that we had each other, and it was never, this is Emily's experience, right? It was, here are all of our experiences, and we're not identifying which of us had each of these individual experiences. It almost doesn't matter because we've all had very similar experiences. But I think that the more we talk about these things, the more we can destigmatize them and help to advance people's understanding of conditions like ADHD so that they can see that it's not an excuse, right? That it's not just, people sort of joke about it, right? They mention, I'm being kind of ADHD today or whatever. And that's really kind of harmful to people who do have ADHD, right? When other people joke about being kind of ADHD, that sort of thing, that kind of minimizes the experience, which can be really debilitating at a lot of times for many of us. And so, if we can kind of destigmatize it while also working to share our experiences and show people that that this is something that happens, and that, you know, you can still be an academic, right? It's actually, I think, fairly common amongst academics. Maybe this kind of work environment appeals to people with ADHD. It's often, you know, is coincides with people who are gifted and things like that. So I think that can happen as well. But this sort of environment where you can pursue your passions, I think, is something that appeals to folks with ADHD to some extent. But, you know, the more we can enhance people's understanding of it, I think the better the world will be, which is, I think, the case for all of this, right? Kind of why I do this work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as we wrap up our conversation, Emily, in reflecting on threads across these two articles that are really speaking to issues of uncertainty and stigma surrounding women's health issues, what are some final takeaways that you'd like to leave us with?
You know, I think that, you know, we are living in a time when women's bodily rights vary by state. Mm-hmm. The choices that we can make about our bodies are different when you cross a state line. And so, you know, they think focusing on women, you know, women's health experiences have a very different history, right? You know, the fact that women are diagnosed with ADHD as adults more often than men are, right? It comes to a lot of our historical understanding of diseases and the way they manifest being gendered. And so I think we see this in lots of areas in health, right? We see lots of health disparities. And I think that it's important to continue to consider those and pay attention to those and try to fix that as much as we can. You know, and this also happens with breastfeeding, but I think that as I mentioned, and lots of other health issues, you know, women's experiences of heart attacks are different from men's, and thus they are less likely to get diagnosed early when that is happening. Right. And so, I think in terms of our communication work, we need to continue to share our stories so that people have a better understanding and so that we can kind of try to continue to work to eliminate these disparities in health. And that when we talk about these experiences and when providers have a better understanding of what they're like, understanding that they're normal, but also understanding the struggle involved in them. You know, I'll share that when I first brought to my primary care provider that I thought I might have ADHD and filled out the little self-diagnosis scale. And she looked at it and said, well, okay, it does look like you probably have this, but like you have a PhD, right? Like clearly you have coping mechanisms. Do you really need medicine? Mm-hmm. I said, but what if it doesn't have to be this hard? And it doesn't, it turns out, right? Amazingly, it is not this hard when I have, right? When my brain has its glasses, essentially, right? You know, when I've talked to friends whose kids seem to have ADHD and they're concerned about medicating them, I always come back to, well, if your kid needed glasses, would we be having this conversation, right? Your kid's brain needs glasses. Your kid's brain needs a little bit of help to do the things that it needs to be doing, and that's okay, right? So, you know, talking about these things is really important, and I think one of the key ways to disrupt that stigma, help people to see that they are not alone, and give them language and tools to help deal with these things.
Amen. I, like you, believe that storytelling in its finest moments can improve individuals' abilities to not only tolerate the uncertainty that stems from the limits of medical knowledge, but also to thrive in situations that are stemming from unique personal experiences and ways we move through the world. So thanks for sharing yours, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining Emily Kripe and I for this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Gerald Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates more just and joyful communities. Joe Bianco and I are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DM Podcast, WOUB. In the show notes and on our Facebook page, we provide links to Emily's articles published in Health Communication that we've been talking about today. Thank you, and be well.